Hello, it's Monday, May 6, 2024. I'm Arlene Ford, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Current and New York Times with me today is Lou Mirando. Let's begin by taking a look at the photos on the front page of the Hartford Current, and there are three of them. The first one we're looking at, we see an individual. It's a guy. He's dressed. He has a baseball cap on, a T-shirt, and, of course, it looks like jeans. And in this photo, he is at one of the electric charging stations, and he is charging his vehicle. And the caption under the photo reads, Jonathan Roach of Springfield, Massachusetts, charges his rental car during his lunch break at the Electrify America charging station in November in Manchester. And we're going to be doing a story on this later on in the broadcast about the electric vehicle legislation. And our next photo, we're looking at a young lady. She's got long, dark brown hair. She's dressed in black, and she's holding an enlarged photo of her twin brother. And I'll read the caption. It says, Clarice L. Robbie holds a photo of her twin brother, Michael Randall Sr., at the New Haven Green on Thursday. She lost her brother 5 years ago in a fire. And we're going to be doing a story on that as well later on in the broadcast. And then the last photo, we see someone's hands holding a cell phone, and they're doing banking on their phone. And the caption here reads, a recent survey showed 45% of Americans favored mobile apps for managing their banking, and just 14% sought out a branch. And that's it for the photos on the front page of the Current. Let's now go to Lou for pictures of the front page of the New York Times.
Hello. Today we'll be doing Monday, May 6, 2024, New York Times front pages. And the first big picture is that of four workmen in white jumpsuits. And this is in Brazil. And you can see that they're walking through a field of tilled mounds of soil. And basically the picture is that of how Brazil is slowly changing from cattle ranches to other methods of farming to avoid planet warming carbon emissions. As a result, for the cattle ranches, they're taking down rainforests. So we're going to have a story on that. It's hard to explain the photo, but the story will explain it better. Then there's another small picture of a headstone, a bronze headstone in the ground for a Marcus Johnson. And there's a bouquet of flowers just above it. And he was a prisoner, and he died from a mental collapse in a prison. And we're going to have a story about mental illness in prisons. And then the third picture is that of an artist by the name of Frank Stella. He was a minimalist painter and reinvention, and he used to create very large murals. And he passed away, and we're going to have a short story on that also. And that's it for the front page of the New York Times. We'll start with the lead story from Arlene now.
12 Ukrainians hurt in Russian drone attack on Orthodox Easter. This is out of Kiev. As Ukrainian marked its third Easter at war, Russia launched a barrage of drones Sunday concentrated in Ukraine's east, wounding more than a dozen people, and said its troops took control of a village they had been targeting. Ukraine's Air Force said Russia had launched 24 Shahed drones overnight, of which 23 were shot down. Six people, including a child, were wounded in a drone strike in the eastern Kharkiv region, Regional Governor Oleh Sinubov said. 14 more were wounded in an airstrike Sunday afternoon on the regional capital, also called Kharkiv. The regional prosecutor's office had said. Sinubov said the city was attacked by an aerial bomb. Fires broke out when debris from drones that were shot down fell on buildings in the neighboring Dnipropetrovsk region. No casualties were reported. The Russian Ministry of Defense announced Sunday that its troops had taken control of Octrotine, which has been in the crosshairs of Russian forces in the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine. Drone footage obtained by the Associated Press showed the village battered by fighting. Not a single person is seen in the footage obtained late Friday, and no building in Octrotine appears to have been left untouched by the fighting. Officials in Kiev urge residents to follow Orthodox Easter services online, citing safety concerns. Sahir Popko, head of the Kiev City Administration, warned that even on such bright days of celebration, we can expect evil deeds from the aggressor. In his Easter address, President Volodymyr Zelensky called on Ukrainians to be united in one common prayer. A majority of Ukrainians identify as Orthodox Christians, although the church is divided. Many belong to the Independent Orthodox Church of Ukraine. The rival Ukrainian Orthodox Church was loyal to the Patriarch in Moscow until splitting from Russia after the 2022 invasion and is viewed with suspicion by many Ukrainians. Thieves killed... Now, this is about another story, missing tourist in Mexico. Thieves killed two Australians and an American on a surfing trip to Mexico in order to steal their truck, particularly because they wanted the tires, authorities said Sunday. Baja California state prosecutors released grisly details of the slayings, but have not yet officially confirmed the identification of the bodies. They said family members of the victims are viewing the bodies to see if they can be identified by sight. The corpses were decomposing after the thieves dumped them into a remote 50-foot deep well about 4 miles from where the foreigners were killed. If relatives can't identify the bodies, further tests will be conducted. The well also contained a fourth cadaver that had been there much longer. The probability that it's them is very high, Chief State Prosecutor Maria Elena Andre Ramirez said. The three men were on a camping and surfing trip along a stretch of coast south of the city of Ensenada, posting idyllic photos on social media of waves and isolated beaches. They went missing last weekend.
Negotiations between Israel and Hamas hit an impasse, by Adam Gregson. The latest round of negotiations between Israel and Hamas hit an impasse on Sunday as mediators struggled to bridge remaining gaps and a Hamas delegation departed the talks in Cairo, according to two senior Hamas officials and two other officials familiar with the talks. An Israeli official also confirmed the negotiations had stalled and described them as being in crisis. For months, the negotiations aimed at achieving a ceasefire and a release of hostages have made little progress. But signs the two sides were coming closer to an agreement appeared over the last weekend. Israel backed off some of its long-standing demands, and a top Hamas official said the group was studying the latest Israeli offer with a positive spirit. But the setback over the weekend meant Palestinians living in miserable conditions in Gaza would not experience an immediate reprieve, and the families of hostages held by militants would have to wait longer for the freedom of their loved ones. The main obstacle of the talks was the duration of the ceasefire, with Hamas demanding it be permanent and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel expressing openness to only a temporary halt in the fighting. Hamas blamed the lack of progress on Mr. Netanyahu, who vowed again that the Israeli army will invade Rafah, the southernmost town in Gaza Strip, with or without agreement. We are very close, but Netanyahu's narrow-mindedness aborted an agreement, Musa al-Abzor, a senior Hamas official, said in a phone interview. The Israeli official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the Israeli and Hamas were closer to a deal a couple of days ago, but that Mr. Netanyahu's statements about Rafah had compelled Hamas to harden its demands in an attempt to ensure that Israel forces won't enter the city. Hamas, Mr. Abu Mazarik said, thought that Mr. Netanyahu wanted an agreement that would permit Israel to invade Rafah after its hostages are released. The Biden administration has been pressing Israel to refrain for undertaking a major operation in Rafah, where about 1 million Palestinians have been sheltering since the start of the war. On Monday, Hamas's political leadership will convene in Doha to discuss what unfolded in Cairo over the past 2 days. The group intended to continue participating in negotiations with positivity, said one of the senior Hamas officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity.
Protesters agreed to clear out of USC encampment. Graduations held elsewhere, some flags for Gaza seen. Students protesting the war in Gaza left a pro-Palestinian encampment at the University of Southern California early Sunday after they were surrounded by police and told they could face arrest if they didn't go. While Northeastern University's commencement began peacefully at Boston's Fenway Park. Developments in both places were being watched closely following scores of recent arrests. The USC move days before commencement is set to begin came after the university said campus safety officers assisted by the Los Angeles Police Department were clearing the area. If you are in the center of campus, please leave. People who don't leave could be arrested, USC said on the social platform X around 4:15 a.m. Live stream video from student journalists showed that the encampment had emptied out as police formed a line to move remaining protesters away and stop people from reentering. The encampment had restarted after the LAPD arrested 93 people on April 24th. The atmosphere on campus had largely remained calm since then, while attention turned to arrests at the University of California, Los Angeles. In Boston, commencement for Northeastern saw some students waving Palestinian flags, but those were dotted among flags from India, the U.S., and other nations. Graduate students went first, with undergraduate commencement in the afternoon. Last month, police arrested about 100 protesters at Northeastern when they broke up an encampment. At the University of Virginia, 25 people were arrested Saturday for trespassing after police clashed with pro-Palestinian protesters who refused to remove tents from campus, and demonstrators at the University of Michigan chanted anti-war messages and waved flags during commencement ceremonies. USC, a private university, has been the subject of student protest over the war, as well as the administration's decision to cancel a commencement speech by the valedictorian, a Muslim student who had expressed support for Palestinians. The university made that decision last month, citing safety concerns after receiving threats. Some Jewish groups had criticized the student's selection as speaker. Administrators later canceled the entire main stage commencement planned for May 10th, when 65,000 people were expected to gather. Other activities, including graduation ceremonies for individual schools and colleges, are still scheduled from Thursday through Sunday. Access to campus has largely been restricted since late April for people not affiliated with the university. It was the latest clash at U.S. colleges and universities that have seen dozens of protests over the Israel-Hamas war. Many of the encampments have been dismantled by police. Tent encampments of protesters urging universities to stop doing business with Israel or companies they say support the war in Gaza have spread in a student movement unlike any other this century. Some schools reached agreements with protesters to end the demonstrations and reduce the possibility of disrupting final exams and commencements.
In Biden's bid for re-election, he spotlights the insulin price gap by Zolan Cano-Young. Kay Peterson, a 66-year-old retired librarian, is a direct beneficiary of one of President Biden's proudest domestic policy achievements, lowering the cost of insulin for seniors. A longtime diabetic, Ms. Peterson, for much of her life, spent around $300 a month on insulin to keep her blood sugar at a safe level. Now she pays $35 and uses the savings to help fund her room in the assisted living facility in Kentucky. Mr. Biden's policy, she said on a recent afternoon, was a godsend because it enshrines into law that Americans on Medicare, the federal health insurance program that covers people over 65 and some younger ones with certain disabilities, will not spend more than $35 per month on insulin. As Mr. Biden makes his case for re-election, he regularly cites the cap on out-of-pocket costs for insulin on TikTok in campaign advertisements and in speeches around the country. He sees the law as a crucial part of his record heading into the 2024 election, with bipartisan support and particular resolution for Americans with diabetes, one of the most common chronic diseases in America. It also mirrors something of a generation gap in Mr. Biden's base of support. Recent polling shows that voters older than 65 who usually vote Republican are emerging as reliable supporters of Mr. Biden. Younger voters, however, are showing signs of dissatisfaction, and some of these voters say that they are still hoping for the reassurance of having the $35 limit written into law for them. Biden is doing better with older voters than he anticipated, and I think his Medicare policies are an important part of that, said Jeff Garland, a pollster for Biden campaign. But he acknowledges that among younger voters, there's some frustration with them that change is not happening quickly enough. But Biden campaign officials look to the state of Georgia as an example of how powerful the issue can be. During the 2022 Georgia runoff won by Senator Raphael Warnock, he focused his ads, debates, and speeches on capping the cost of insulin. Mr. Warnock said that the issue can be a way of galvanizing voters of color. Black people are disproportionately likely to ration insulin as well as to energize a broader coalition. It's an equity issue, a justice issue, and a people issue, Mr. Warnock said. Before that, when he struggled to pay for insurance, he said he needed to choose between a roof over my kid's head or pay for my medicine. He, too, rationed his insulin on one occasion and landed in the intensive care unit. I remember hearing my own flatline, Mr. Martin said. A lot of people says when you die, your life flashes before you. What I had seen was my kids growing up without me. Mr. Martin is not sure Mr. Biden's policy will be enough to win his vote, but he says Mr. Biden has won his respect. You don't know how many lives you're saving, Mr. Martin said. I would shake his hand and say thanks.
Trump trial has dry bases, juicy bits. Business angle not part of the engaging testimony as it opens. This is out of New York. Former President Donald Trump is on trial facing 34 felony counts of what could be the dullest sounding crime in New York's penal code, falsifying business records. Yet across nine witnesses and 2 weeks of testimony, jurors have been treated to hours of mesmerizing courtroom theater. There was talk of a sex scandal with an adult film star, a surreptitious recording of a future president, and the tearful testimony of a former confidant in the glare of the witness stand. There was even a celebrity roll call. Charlie Sheen, Lindsay Lohan, and reality television star Tila Tequila, were all name-checked, drawing chuckles in the lower Manhattan courtroom. The phrase falsifying business records, however, was not uttered to the jury during testimony. That striking omission underscores the prosecution's strategy for the opening phase of testimony. Spotlight the sleaze and soft-pedal the records. Although the defense has taken a swipe at the approach, legal experts say it represents the prosecution's best shot at winning the case, the first criminal trial of an American president. In their opening statement, prosecutors from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office preview the false records to the jurors, casting them as straightforward paper lies that covered up a hush money payment to the adult film star. But tying Trump to those records is hardly simple. Only one witness directly links Trump to falsifying the records, and that person, as the defense noted, is a convicted liar. So the prosecution started with the strongest card in its hand, eliciting testimony about the sordid stories that Trump is accused of covering up. Prosecutors say he concealed them to shield his 2016 campaign from scandal, orchestrating an illegal conspiracy to undermine the integrity of a presidential election. Trump is not charged with conspiracy, but New York law requires prosecutors to show that Trump falsified the records to conceal another crime. The purported election conspiracy and all its lurid detail would essentially establish his motive. By foregrounding the conspiracy, prosecutors are captivating the jury while laying a foundation for evidence about the business records to emerge. In Manhattan, Trump is one of dozens of defendants to face the falsifying business records charge over the past decade. Prosecutors can charge it as a felony rather than a misdemeanor only if a defendant falsified the records to commit or conceal another crime, and the district attorney's office almost always charges it as a felony. In Trump's case, the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, has said the former president was trying to cover up the election conspiracy.